Okay, so the these are the things that we will look at today. And so one of the first ones here, Satipatthana develops mindfulness, is the idea which is quite common, and it comes from translations such as foundations of mindfulness, is that what we are developing when we are doing Satipatthana practice is mindfulness itself. The purpose of Satipatthana is somehow to develop mindfulness further. But as we have seen before, the purpose of Satipatthana is really to develop samadhi. So how, what is going on here? And I'm going to discuss that a little bit as we go along. And some of these, when I say myths and misconceptions, it doesn't mean that they're necessarily entirely wrong, but there is like a slight, not quite right, what some of these kind of ideas, how they work out. Another one is the idea that you are either mindful or you are not. But this is problematic because mindfulness is something that has many different degrees to it, and it matters enormously the kind of degree you have for your ability to have insight, for example, to see things according to reality, the famous Yata Buddha Nanadasana of Buddhism. We have Satipatthana is the one and only way. This is an important one, an interesting one. This is in the Pali is called the Ekayana, Ekayana Mago. And in a very interesting discussion about what this actually means, the Ekayana Mago, because this is one of the words that is used to define Satipatthana, and that is why it is fascinating. Very often translated as the one and only way. Is that really correct or not? One of the things we're going to talk about. Satipatthana is all about direct observation. Anupassana, vipassana means direct observation. And I think we already talked about this partly, but this is, again, this is problematic when you understand Satipatthana in a broader sense. Breath meditation belongs to body contemplation, and this is an outcome of looking at the Satipatthana Sutta in isolation without understanding the broader ideas of Satipatthana. Satipatthana is to be practiced in everyday life. I discussed this yesterday. I'm going to bring this up again today, and we're going to take that a bit deeper. Yesterday was I enjoyed the talk yesterday myself, but the point of a course like this is to take these ideas a bit more deeply so you understand why this is problematic from a Satipatthana perspective. Because it's very important to understand why. When you understand why, you get some confidence in these ideas. If you don't understand why, if you're just told this is the way it is, well, then you will have doubts. But the more clear you are about the reasons behind it, and you find those reasons acceptable, and you have an opportunity to ask about those reasons and maybe bring in your own experience or whatever, then, of course, that confidence arises that this actually is the appropriate way of thinking about Satipatthana practice and right mindfulness. The last one, which is one of my favorites, is the misconception that Satipatthana is a very important part of Satipatthana is watching the breath, watching the pain. Please pick me up when I say crazy things like that. So, no, Satipatthana does not necessarily include watching pain. It doesn't mean that there is no pain. Sometimes all experience in life includes some degree of pain. But it's not a necessary component of Satipatthana practice. And this is really the point here. And I will discuss in detail why that is the case. And it's closely related to the idea of what it means to observe something, what it means to have insight into something, and how these things come about. So that is the menu for today. So I hope you like the menu. If you don't like the menu, well, you choose the parts that you like as most menus, and we'll see what happens. So let's fire away. Let's start with the what's coming next. Okay, so the first one, Satipatthana develops mindfulness. This is not what the suttas actually say. What we find in the suttas is actually something quite different. Satipatthana is not, the purpose of Satipatthana, as we have seen already, is actually samadhi and not mindfulness itself. So this is how the path works. Let's have a quick look at the path. So we have the first six factors of the Noble Eightfold Path. We talked about this already. One leading to the next one, all the way down to right effort. And then based on these first six factors, this is where you develop mindfulness, through the first six factors. So when you come to Satipatthana, you already have mindfulness to a reasonable degree, sufficient to be able to do Satipatthana practice, which is what? Which is basically meditation practice. So you develop that quality of mind which enables you to meditate. You develop that through the first six factors of the Noble Eightfold Path. And then when the mindfulness is powerful enough, then you're able to do meditation practice. So this is where mindfulness is developed. So after all of this, that's where you have right mindfulness. And then right mindfulness itself does not develop more mindfulness. What it develops is right stillness. And this is a very important distinction because right stillness has many factors that are in addition to mindfulness. There's many things in samadhi which you don't find in mindfulness, in Satipatthana. And one of the things that you find with stillness is obviously stillness, right? So there is stillness there, and it is that stillness, that ability to stay with something, that is kind of one of the fundamental mental qualities that you require to be able to get insight, because you have to stay with something for a long time often to be able to get insight into that phenomenon. If things are just flashing before your eyes, like things are in daily life, always moving, always changing, there's not enough time, not enough standing back, not enough clarity to really be able to have insight into that phenomenon. So you have to stand back a little bit, and then that is where you have that ability to see that stillness is so important. It also empowers the mind. The mind gets really bright. And of course, when the mind is empowered and very bright, it means that what you see is just so much more. You see everything. All the aspects of what is going on, because the mind has that sharpness to it that enables these things. And this is an aspect of coming from samadhi, and not an aspect that comes from mindfulness itself. Stillness in its own right is very important. So this is why it's not just the development of mindfulness, it's more than that when we talk about what Satipatthana actually does, bringing the mind to samadhi. So this is the standard formula that we looked at before. This is the short formula or the summary formula of Satipatthana when a monastic meditates by observing an aspect of the body, keen, aware, and mindful. Satima, mindful. So the idea here is that these particular words, keen, aware, and mindful, these are words that qualify how Satipatthana is done. When you do Satipatthana, you are already mindful. This is a quality of mind you bring to Satipatthana. You cannot really do Satipatthana without mindfulness. So you establish it first, then you apply the mindfulness. That is why we translate Satipatthana as the application of mindfulness, because you apply it to the four areas of body, feelings, mind, and principles or mental phenomena, dhammas in the Pali. So it's really an application. It is a use of mindfulness that you have in Satipatthana practice, which purpose is to take you to samadhi. Quite obvious when you see it in there, but still, it's not always clear. Sometimes I'm surprised that the sort of people that can make this kind of have these kind of ideas. It is still the case that mindfulness does develop through the practice, but that is not the purpose of the practice. The purpose of it is, again, samadhi. But of course, when samadhi develops, because of the sharpness of the mind, you can argue that mindfulness is also sharper. So it's true that mindfulness does develop as you practice, but that's not the purpose of Satipatthana. The purpose here is to give rise to samadhi, give rise to wisdom. And when you have more samadhi and wisdom, of course, all the previous factors on the path, they are strengthened because you develop the higher ones. So even though it's not the purpose, it is true that mindfulness does develop because it becomes more, your mind is brighter, you're more present than you were before. But that's a kind of almost like a byproduct of samadhi. Yeah, it's really a byproduct of the development of stillness of the mind. It is stillness, samadhi, that is the real purpose of satipatthana practice. This is just a, I think, a point that I bring up because it is important to understand that the path is more than satipatthana. Yeah, if you think that satipatthana develops mindfulness, satipatthana develops satipatthana, then you are underestimating the significance of the other factors of the path. The other factors are what actually make this whole thing work. And that is why this matters quite significantly, why this is so significant, this idea. Okay. Let's just do one more of these misconceptions before we take a short break. And the next one is that you are either mindful or you are not. This is the idea that once mindfulness is established, well, then you are ready to do insight meditation, yeah? Because mindfulness means that you are in the present. Well, if you are in the present, well, that's it. That's all we require to have insight, yeah? But the problem is that if this were true, then you could gain all the insight, yeah? Once sati, once mindfulness is established. And this is a large part about the idea of where, you know, the idea of not samadhi not being required, where that comes from. It comes from these kind of ideas that the moment when you are mindful, well, then that means you can observe phenomena. And because you can observe phenomena, you don't really need anything more than mindfulness. Once you get into the present, that's it. You're okay. The reality is that it's not as simple as that. It's not really the case that you are either mindful or you're not. The mindfulness comes in a large number of different degrees. And the most important aspect that decides the degree of sati that you have depends on samadhi and wisdom. And if you look at some of the suttas, you find this in the... here you have SN 48.12. This is from the Indriya Samyutta. This is the spiritual faculties sutta. And one sutta from there. And what it shows you is that all the five faculties, depend ultimately on your wisdom faculty. The wisdom faculty is like the highest faculty. And all the other ones, the strength of them will all depend on how strong your wisdom is. The wiser you are as a person, the more powerful your sati will be. So if you have someone who is a noble person, a stream enter, a sotapanna, or whatever, the spiritual faculty will be very, very powerful. And because the spiritual faculties, the sati is so powerful, it is easy for them to enter samadhi, for example. You can expect a person, a noble person, to enter samadhi with ease. This is one of the qualities of a noble person. Samadhi is easily accessible to you. And this way it goes all the way up. And the higher you are in wisdom, the more powerful these kind of faculties are. When you have incredible stillness of the mind, peace is very strong. You have all the concomitant factors that come with that peace, the power of the mind, the luminosity of the mind, the brightness of the mind, all of these kind of things, that is when sati becomes super duper powerful. And that is where insight becomes possible, only really at that point. The reason why I'm saying this is simply because if mindfulness was enough, it means that you could stop at satipatthana and you could have all the insights you wanted at that point. But that is not the case. That's why we have a Noble Eightfold Path. It is not the case. That's why we develop that sati further through the other indriyas here, especially samadhi and wisdom. And only then do we really have that sufficient power to have deep insight into the nature of reality. So mindfulness needs the power and brightness of samadhi to gain deep insight. That then becomes the eighth factor of the Noble Eightfold Path. And that is when you are ready the final aspects of awakening itself. Okay, let's just stop there for a few minutes and just have a just do some quick 5-minute meditation, and then we'll do some questions afterwards. So. Okay, excellent. Yeah, sadhu. Okay. Very good, yeah. Thanks. Okay. So let's continue. Are there any questions on what we have looked at so far? Yeah. Anyone want to say anything about that? Any comments? Any complaints? Anything at all? Everyone's supremely happy? Yeah? Okay. Okay. Excellent. Yeah.
Well, there are a few questions.
Yeah.
I'll start with the online question first. Zhong Yi An asks, Bhante, isn't right mindfulness, is mindfulness applied to all factors of the Noble Eightfold Path, like how MN117 describes 8 mindful steps to happiness?
Is it all... I don't think MN117 really talks about 8 mindful steps. Well, it's true. I think MN117, this is the Great 40 Sutta, what it talks about is... it's true, you use mindfulness to enter upon right speech, etc. But MN117 is mostly about the noble disciple, yeah? So the Aryas, really. Yeah? And of course, they will have right mindfulness almost all the time. So it's a bit of a specialized sutta. It doesn't necessarily mean that in for ordinary people. Yeah? And for ordinary people, often your mindfulness is not very strong. Yeah, you know what it can be like in daily life. You get really easily distracted. Yeah? And many things are happening, and your mind is all over the place. You're thinking about 10 things at the same, well, not actually the same time, but it looks like the same time, yeah, because it's kind of moving around so quickly. Sometimes they call that multitasking, not recommended. We don't recommend that in Buddhism, too much multitasking, because it just makes you confused and lose your focus. So I would say not really. Mindfulness, right mindfulness, is really when you apply the mind to meditation. It's really limited to that, yeah? And so you sit down, you meditate, and then you apply the mind to the breath. That is called right mindfulness. And I would say there isn't such a thing usually as right mindfulness in daily life. We shouldn't really try too hard just to be mindful for its own sake. It's very common in the Buddhist world to say, just be mindful all day, and that's the whole instruction. It doesn't tell you why you should be mindful during the day. It doesn't give any reasons for that, yeah? But we need some reason, because mindfulness in its own right is kind of neutral. It doesn't take you anywhere. You can be mindful of all kind of crazy things, yeah? You can be mindful of doing bad things, yeah? But that's not the point. The point is that mindfulness has to have a purpose. And then when we start to understand the purpose, whatever limited ability you have to be aware during daily life, you use it for that purpose. And of course, that purpose is basically to live more skillfully, to live with more kindness, to live with less of the defilements of the mind. That is really the purpose in daily life. So I would prefer to limit the word mindfulness and to use it to meditation practice, because then we are in line with what the Satipatthana Sutta is saying and what the Anapanasati Sutta, the Sutta on Mindfulness of Breathing, is saying. Anything before that is really more like sense restraint or clear comprehension or something like that.
Okay. Next question is from Eddie Tim. Bhante, so in short, what are the connection between meditation, mindfulness, and kindness?
Okay, in short, kindness leads to mindfulness, and mindfulness is what enables meditation. That's in short. Okay, next one. Yeah.
The next question comes from Ananda, who couldn't make it today. Okay. So he's emailed this to Leha, who sent it to me in a text message. He has asked 3 questions, but Ananda, I'm only going to ask 1 per set of questions. Otherwise, it would be all about you. The first question is, Ajahn, as you have proved to us that the original Satipatthana Sutta most likely would have contained only the item 1-4, focusing on the repulsive, in the broader section of observing the body, I think he means contained only the items 1 and 4 in focusing on the repulsive, in the broader section on observing the body, would you say that the Lord Buddha may have discoursed the original sutta as an exclusive method for the practice of discernment of principles? And then he says, Ajahn, even though...
Let's just stop there, Robin, okay. Because it's going to get too much.
It's a lot.
I won't be able to follow anywhere. So let's just take that first of all, and then we can, yeah, we'll get back to the other one. So first of all, I asubha can be translated in many ways. The word behind Ananda's repulsive there is the Pali word asubha. And subha means the beautiful, and asubha means the non-beautiful. It doesn't necessarily mean repulsive. And I think one of the points of this kind of practice, when you see it in the context of Satipatthana, we get back to these individual practices later on, but when you see it in context of Satipatthana, is to reduce attachment to the body and the five senses, yeah? Because this is what stops us from gaining deeper meditation. If you are attached to the five senses, which always go out in the world, you cannot at the same time withdraw the five senses and go within. These are like opposite poles, yeah? Either you do one or you do other. You can't do both at the same time. That's impossible. So the idea with contemplating the asubha, the 31 parts of the body, is not so much to get repelled by the body. The idea is to neutralize the body. Okay, this body, how beautiful actually is it? Take off the skin, yeah? How beautiful is the body without skin? I don't know if you saw, we had a few years ago, we had this a German kind of scientist called Günther von der Hagen, I think his name was. You were there, yeah. And it was called Körperwelten or something like that. My German is non-existent. But something like Körperwelten, which means the world of bodily worlds or something like that. And he had taken all the skin off the bodies, yeah? And then they had plasticized the bodies so that the bodies didn't deteriorate. And then he had displayed them on this display here. And when you saw those bodies without skin, it kind of lost a bit of the attraction, right? It was, okay, well, this is not quite the same anymore, yeah? So, and this is kind of the idea behind this, is to, okay, well, what is this body, yeah? Well, okay, blood vessels, yeah, a few muscles in here, not too much muscles anymore, kind of, but a bit of muscles in here, a bit of, you know, you have the stomach, you have the intestines going back and forth. I've seen those diagrams, I assume those diagrams are like back and forth, and then you have the heart up here somewhere, you have the kind of the liver or whatever, and all of these things, and once you start to realize what is there, yeah, it's only, you know, they're all saying that beauty is only skin deep. There's a lot of truth to that, yeah? Take the skin off. There isn't much more there. And so it's just about neutralizing this attraction to the body, realizing how shallow it actually is. What we are attracted to is actually very superficial things. And as Ajahn Brahm likes to point out, those superficial things, actually, they're all dead anyway, yeah? The skin is kind of dead. The live stuff underneath, that's actually not all that attractive. The dead stuff, that's what we kind of attach to. So it's kind of, it's a bit, so that is really the purpose here. And once you gain a bit more distance to that body, once you see it a bit more neutrally, it allows you to reduce your desire for that world of the five senses. It has become less attractive. The body is one of the biggest problems, yeah? So you get rid of that. And you focus on your own body. And when you see your own body being not so interesting, well, other people's bodies kind of fall by the wayside at the same time. So this is really the idea here. So it is really, that's why it is a samatha practice. That's why it leads to calming of the mind. So you're saying it leads to the discernment of principles. Well, in a sense it does, because when you discern the body in the right way, that is like a discernment of the nature of reality. So it is a kind of a discernment of principle. You're seeing the asubha, the non-beautiful nature of the body. We often talk about the three characteristics in Buddhism, yeah? Impermanence, suffering and non-self. And sometimes a fourth characteristic is added, and that fourth characteristic is the asubha characteristics, the non-beautiful. So in that sense, it is a insight kind of thing. You see the body, and that then leads to more calm. Yeah, vipassana and samatha going together. You look at the body, see it rightly, it leads to calm. This is this idea that vipassana and samatha, calm and clear seeing, are completely interlinked with each other. Some people say that the repulsiveness of the body is a samatha practice because it leads to calm, but it's also a vipassana practice because you're trying to see the nature of the body. Yeah, so it is both coming together. So again, you cannot really say it is a discernment of phenomena only. It is part of the path leading to samatha. Yeah, and that's why it is found at the early stages, because this then allows you to let go of the body, which then allows the process of watching the breath to happen without interference of the body and the five senses. Okay, go on to point some point. Okay, just wait, Conrad. We'll finish off Ananda's questions first of all.
This is only one question out of, I think,
yeah,
three, but I won't ask the other two just yet.
I think the other two,
they can wait till later
on. He actually gave it up. He gave up those other two questions.
Did he?
Yeah, so it's only one question. Yeah.
I think you may have actually already covered most of what he's asking in this part. Ajahn, even though the practice of observing the body parts simply as parts of the body may help calm the body and mind as an integral part of the body scan exercise, would you say, Ajahn, that the purpose of that section may have been intended more for the rising of repulsion, nibbida, by looking at the repulsiveness of each body part through the practice of unattractiveness of the body, asubha bhavana, and to develop the three characteristics of impermanence, suffering and not self by observing the simile of the bag of grains given in the second section of 1.4. And then he goes on to say, Ajahn, the above thoughts and the subsequently arising questions arose in my mind when I came across Maha Chunda Sutta, AN 646, especially the last two paragraphs referring to mendicants who practice discernment of principles, Dhamma Yoga Samana, and mendicants who practice absorption meditation, Jayi Samana.
Okay. Okay, so is it about seeing the three characteristics? I don't think it is so much about seeing the three characteristics. I think it's mostly about just asubha, about seeing the non-beautiful aspect of the body. I think that's the main thing. Yeah. I don't think you necessarily see... I mean, of course, you can see impermanence that way because you can focus on how these things arise and pass away, but I don't think that's the main purpose here. The purpose is to take the mind towards samadhi. So it is that, we call it nibbida. I would say it's more like just taking away the... Nibbida is a very profound thing. Nibbida, which means repulsion aversion, it's like the stage of the path very close to enlightenment where you are kind of repelled by the whole world because you see that the world is suffering. Yeah, but here we're talking about a much more preliminary stage where we're just trying to see the body more clearly so as to have less attraction to that realm. That's the purpose here, so that you can allow your mind to become more peaceful and neutral as a consequence. Conrad, you wanted to say something here?
Thanks, Ajahn. My question was about, you made the comment before that when you use the term mindfulness, you just talk about meditation.
Yeah.
And I know you referenced it last week, but I can't remember it being talked about. Just the part of this sutta where it says that we're mindful when we eat, we're mindful when we defecate. Like those more living types of mindfulness that it refers to in this sutta. So I wondered... Yeah. What your thoughts were.
Sure. That makes sense. Part, I'll come back to this later on because it's an important part of the presentation. But just in brief, that part belongs before meditation. It is kind of the what leads up to meditation. It's part of the sense restraint aspect, the ability to kind of be aware in daily lives. So you don't do things that kind of lead to negative mind states. So that's the kind of the outcome of that one. It's wrong, and it doesn't belong in meditation at all, but it belongs at an earlier point on the path.
Is it mindfulness?
It is. There's always some degree of mindfulness there. Even now, you have to have some degree of mindfulness to be able to even listen to things, or to speak or whatever it is. But the point is that there is a particular kind of mindfulness that is required to do meditation, and that is a deeper kind of mindfulness. And that is what we're trying to aim for. And that mindfulness is the mindfulness where the mind is basically free of desires and ill will and that kind of thing, because these are the things that take you out into the past and the future, etc. And that's why sense restraint is so important, because sense restraint is what calms down the desires and the aversion that we have for things in the world. So there is mindfulness all the way, but the mindfulness we're talking about in Satipatthana is basically the ability to be in the present without really going away from the present moment. That's really what we're talking about.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Anybody else?
Okay. So now let us move on to the next one. So this is the idea that Satipatthana is the one and only way. And this is, actually, let me go back and I will show you where this arises in the suttas because it's kind of useful to see. So, it's not there. I haven't got it here. Oh, okay, never mind. This is very problematic, yeah, because if we talk in Buddhism about the one and only way, well, there is a beautiful verse in the Dhammapada that talks about this. What the Buddha says, what the Buddha, I can't remember the exact wording of the Pali now. Eseva maggo natti anyo satanang visuddhiya, or something like that. Eseva maggo, this is the path. Yeah, eseva maggo, this is the path. Natti anyo, there is no other. Satanang visuddhiya, or something like that, for the purification of beings. So this beautiful verse in the Satipatthana, in the Dhammapada, which is often quoted around the Buddhist world, that makes it clear what is the one and only path, and that is the Noble Eightfold Path. Yeah, that is the one and only path. So when you say that Satipatthana is the one and only path, we're taking out one out of those eight factors and claiming that is the same as the whole path. And that is really problematic. And that leads to this kind of ideas that you just go to a meditation center, you sit down and you practice meditation, that's all you have to do and you're in business. But of course, it's not as simple as that. You have to have all the other factors to support Satipatthana. Only then does it become the full practice. So what is this expression that is used to justify this? And the expression is the following. Ek ayano, ayang maggo. This is the expression that you find in the Satipatthana Sutta itself. Yeah, we saw this last time at the very beginning. This is almost how it starts out. The Buddha says this. The first words that come, I think, after the location of the sutta and that sort of thing. Ek ayano, ayang maggo. What does it actually mean if it does not mean the one and only way? And this is what I want to reflect on a little bit now to find out the meaning of this. And it is remarkably difficult actually to know exactly what the meaning of this is. It may have, probably was much more obvious at the time of the Buddha, but because we come so long after the Buddha in history, actually it is not so obvious what it means. I'll give you a rough idea what it means. Ek ayano. It's eka. Eka is one in Pali. Ayano is the second word there. There's a compounded word. So eka plus ayano. And ayano means going. And ayang maggo. Ayang is this. Maggo is path, right? This is the Aryatangika Magga, the Noble Eightfold Path. So one going this path. Yeah, this path is one going. That's literally what it says. So what exactly does that mean? I'll give you some translations, that are commonly found, and I will discuss them very briefly. This is the sole way. This is one translation that you see quite commonly. This is the sole way. And again, this is problematic because it doesn't really take into account that there is a whole Noble Eightfold Path lying behind this. The sole way is a Noble Eightfold Path, not Satipatthana. Satipatthana is only part and parcel of what is going on here. So this also is problematic. Even though it is better than the one and only, still it is slightly problematic. This is the path that goes in one way only, or in one direction only. Now this is much. Now we're getting closer, because now we are not saying that this is a kind of a standalone thing that takes you all the way to enlightenment. We're saying that this Satipatthana only goes in one direction, and that is kind of acceptable because now we're getting close to the thing. What is going on here? This is the direct path. This is another translation similar to the previous one. This is favored by a number of translators, at least one translator that is very famous at the moment. Again, it's a little bit problematic because it sort of assumes that there might be an indirect path. What would that indirect path be? As if there is a direct path and an indirect path. Actually, there is only one path, and that path is the Noble Eightfold Path, including Sammasamadhi and all of that. So this idea of direct path, again, I find it slightly problematic because it gives this feeling that there is something indirect. And that indirect, sometimes that will be considered a path of samadhi. Yeah, this is kind of where these problems arise. So we want to find a translation that actually captures this well. So when you decide in the suttas what the meaning of a word is, like ekayan or ayang mago, how do you decide the meaning of these kind of words? One thing is to look at the sentence, try to kind of analyze the meanings. The problem with ekayan or ayang mago is that there's many possible ways and meanings of that. So then what you do is you look at other usages of that same word in the sutta. This is a kind of standard way of deciding the meaning of these words. Yeah, look at other usages in the suttas. Then you come to a broad understanding of the word. The problem is this word only occurs in one other place in all the suttas, either in Satipatthana or this one other place. So it's a very little contextual evidence, if you like. Anyway, that place is this particular one. This is found in the Majjhima Nikaya number 12, the middle length saying number 12. This is the Maha Siyanada Sutta, the greater discourse on the lion's roar. And there it means something like, this is a path going in one direction only. Yeah. And now I think we're getting very close to what I would consider an acceptable translation, a path that goes in one direction only. Yeah. One here is the idea of moving towards one thing, eka, going, ayano, yeah? And this is a path. So one is like one direction, one place only. So here we are getting very close. And this is, to me, would be, I think, an acceptable translation. And it makes sense, yeah? Practice Satipatthana, part of the Noble Eightfold Path, just like the rest of the Noble Eightfold Path, it all goes in one direction only. So this, I think, is within the kind of the ballpark. But there is another very interesting possibility of this word. And this is the possibility that was put forward by my good friend Bhante Sujato. And he wrote a whole book called The History of Mindfulness. I put that on as part of the possibility for reading to this course. I know at least one of you read it. I'm not sure how many else have. It's hard going, I have to admit. If you can read that book, then wow, that's pretty. Then you're really solid Buddhist. Yeah, this is not for the faint-hearted. Sometimes people get to the first paragraph and they put it aside because it's just too much. And you really need to know your suttas to really understand what is going on in that book. But I claim I understand what's going on. So I so what does he say? Yeah, and what he says is that to really be able to understand this particular phrase, there is not enough evidence in the suttas. So what we have to do is we have to go outside of the suttas, and we also have to take into what is called the Brahmanical text. These are the texts that exist in the hegemonic spiritual tradition of India at the time that belonged to the Brahmins. Yeah, this was the one tradition that kind of existed in India for hundreds of years prior to the Buddha. And that tradition happens to have used that same word in a spiritual context, yeah, in the context of meditation and the development of the mind. And some of these Brahmanical texts are very close in time to the time of the Buddha, not very far away. Some of these are called the Upanishads, and they are maybe a few centuries, maybe even contemporaneous with the Buddha, maybe a century or two before, so close in time. So we can assume that a similar vocabulary, yeah, would have existed in India between these Brahmanical texts and the Buddhist expression of the spiritual path. So this is actually, this may sound a bit fanciful to go outside of the Buddhist text, but of course we have to remember that the Buddhist texts themselves, the way the Buddha spoke, would have been with reference to the existing culture, the existing environment. How are we going to be able to understand the Buddha properly without having some understanding of that environment? It is very difficult. So studying some of these early texts, not that I would recommend you to do that because it takes you really far afield. I haven't done it myself, so how can I ask you to do it? But for a specialist, it can be very interesting. And then Bhante Sujato, he arrives, this long argument, there's about 10 pages he writes on this one expression, ekayana mago. And after all these things, he arrives at some very interesting conclusions about what it means. I can only see a blur on the screen without my glasses. Okay, thank you, glasses. and this is the translation he arrives at. Ready? Are you excited? Ooh. Ding, 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 ding. This is the path to convergence. Scratch. So what it really means is this is the path going to one is really kind of the what he's saying here. Yeah, convergence means things coming together, going to one. So he's kind of, the literal meaning would be going to one, and then the kind of implied idea here is going to convergence. Yeah, so the path going to one. So what does one mean? If path going to one, well, one, especially in the pre-Buddhist times, but also in Buddhism, one is usually an idea, always related to the idea of samadhi. Yeah, in the suttas you have ekagata citta, eka ekagata. Aga is peak, eka is one. Ekagata means one peaked. Chitta, mind, yeah? This is one of the definitions of samadhi in the suttas. Ekodi bhuta is another definition of samadhi. It means having become one, yeah, unified. So eka is a very common word in the suttas that actually refer to samadhi. So what Bhante Sujato is saying here is that this whole expression ekayano mango means that satipatthana is a path leading to samadhi. Convergence here refers to the convergence of the mind, that is samadhi, stillness. Yeah? So ekayana mago means satipatthana is the path to samadhi. Yeah. So this is his idea. And I don't know if he is being deliberately provocative. I don't think it's beyond him to be deliberately provocative, knowing Ajahn Sujata. But it is actually based on some fairly solid evidence, yeah? And this is why it is very interesting. And I think it is certainly a possible translation here. Whether it actually really means that or not, I think I'm not 100% convinced by the argument. I think that those passages, having looked at them carefully, can be understood in a couple of different ways. So I think there is still a lot of room for, maybe, maybe not. And we don't really need this additional evidence to know that satipatthana leads to samadhi. We have seen that before. The evidence is absolutely overwhelming in the suttas. There's no doubt that it leads to samadhi. I think Bhante Sujato's idea here is just that, okay, well, if it is so obvious that it leads to samadhi, maybe we should expect to find some clear pointers also in the Satipatthana Sutta that actually makes this clear. And this could be one of these points. Yeah, that's kind of the idea. So I have to warn you, this is not really accepted in the Buddhist world, yeah? This is kind of really out on a limb in the Buddhist world. But I like that. I like people who kind of think differently. And Bhante Sujato is really good at kind of looking at things in a different way. So either this means the path going to in one direction only, or it means the path going to samadhi. And I think both of those interpretations are perfectly satisfactory as far as this is concerned. I think we need to take a bit of meditation after that, because that's pretty serious stuff. So let's do 5 minutes of meditation here. Okay. So that is the Ekayano Mago, and I remember that was you. I think. What is your name? Do you mind if I ask you? Yes, Craig. Yeah, Craig. Okay, and I think you were the one who asked about that during the last workshop. I think you, is that right? That one you were asking about. I think you mentioned asked about the meaning of that expression, and I said I was going to come back to it later on or something. So there you are. I did this especially for you, just to kind of make you happy. That's answering your question. And I should warn you, I said before, it's nice to have people who are kind of broad thinking and thinking in new ways and who are like Bhante Sujato is. And I should say that it takes a lot of knowledge to really be creative and to be open to new possibilities. So, very often in our world, I think one of the problems we have in our world is that people think they are experts, often with a very small amount of knowledge, and have very strong opinions about all kinds of things without really having the basis for having opinions. And this, is one of the reasons why we have all these conspiracy theories and all kinds of stuff going on. So it's actually quite hard to have enough knowledge to really be able to draw solid conclusions for something. You really need to know the material very well. And even then, you can easily go wrong. So although it is good to be open-minded, although it is good to think about things in a new ways, it's also important to be humble about one's abilities to do that and to know one's own limitations. Otherwise, you're going to come up with all kinds of crazy ideas. And I can assure you, there's lots of crazy ideas in the Buddhist world about what the Buddhist teachings mean. Yeah, it's just full of people, and you can argue with them till you are blue in the face. And they will still, stand by those arguments. And you just have to shrug your shoulders and walk away from those debates, because you know that there is no way that you are going to convince certain people once they have decided on certain interpretations. So are there any questions about this? What do you think? Do you think it means the path to samadhi, or do you think it means the path going in one direction only? Do you have anyone have any non-humble opinions about this? Thomas?
Just a third paragraph there, convergence first to samadhi. Is that Sujato's meaning, or is that...
Convergence refers to convergence of the mind. That is samadhi. Is that what you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah? Well, that's what he means by it. Yeah, it's referring to samadhi.
Because it kind of looks like another kind of spirituality, almost like, it is a path to going to one, to oneness, to the source, to God, to whatever, right?
Yeah, but that is often
the
same.
That's what more looks like.
Sure, but that is similar to samadhi. Yeah, that would be the same thing, yeah? Because people would say, "Well, converges in God, God and samadhi is the same thing." Yeah.
Oh.
So you know what it is, especially in the Hindu Brahmanical tradition, the idea is Brahma Mahabrahma. How do you attain Mahabrahma? You attain through samadhi. Yeah? So these are not really distinguishable in many of these things. And even if you go to Christian traditions, you attain some deep state of stillness, and they will argue, "This is God. Yeah, I've discovered God. God is there." Yeah, why not? Yeah, the ego is almost completely gone. You seem to be unified with everything. There's no divisions anymore. It's incredibly blissful. It's incredibly powerful. What else could it be than God? Maybe it is God. What else could it
be? Who knows?
Who knows? Well, hopefully the Buddha knows, but that is a very natural conclusion to take. So unless you have some further or additional wisdom to help you out, you're going to get stuck with that. So convergence, God, one, samadhi, it's all the same, right? Maybe. Yeah. Yes, please.
In a minute, Eddie.
My query would be with convergence and with that oneness. Is that something to do with the factors of awakening all come together as well? Sometimes when you experience everything comes together, it's like that stillness then is there.
Yeah, that is the practice of awakening is all about samadhi. Yeah, so that would be the same, similar kind of thing. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. So.
Mine is similar to the previous question. The samadhi in this case means coming to peace, to end of suffering.
The end of suffering, is that what you said? Dealing
with suffering, you know, you reduce. Yeah, reduces peace. Yeah. Put away.
Yeah, samadhi is peace, but it's a particular kind of peace. Yeah, peace comes in many flavors, so to speak. Yeah. I mean, you many degrees and flavors. There's a degree of peace just by being mindful, just by being present. There's a degree of peace there because your mind isn't running around so much anymore. Yeah. There is a peace, even if you have sloth and torpor. Yeah, you're kind of peaceful. Yeah. Falling asleep, it's kind of peaceful in a certain way. Yeah. But this is a particular kind of peace, samadhi. It's a peace which is bright, clear, blissful, unified. Yeah, and it's important to put those qualifications in there to really understand what it is, what it actually is. Otherwise, we might lose the profundity of those experiences. Yes, Mr. Bill.
Luang Thar Mahabua said he was stuck in samadhi or in the bliss of samadhi for about 5 years before Ajahn Mun basically told him to apply panya or wisdom to get out of the bliss and to investigate it more to get into the jhanas.
Yeah. So what is the question? Is that a question or just a comment? The comment, So this is the thing, you know, this is why it is so important to, you know, have a clarity about the suttas and the word of the Buddha. You don't get stuck in these kind of things. You know that there's something beyond. So you know that, you know, this is one of the things. I think you find it in the, what is that sutta called now? What is it called? Mahasaropama Sutta, I think it's called, the sutta on the greater sutta on the simile of the heartwood, Sara, like Dhammasara, Saropama, Opama is a simile. And in there, the Buddha says you should never stop at the preliminary, any kind of preliminary stage. You should go all the way to awakening itself. Yeah, and he makes that particular point. You shouldn't be happy just with being virtuous. You should have meditation. You shouldn't be happy just with meditation. So maybe Mahabhua was so happy, he didn't, I'll just chill with meditation. And then someone said, actually, look at this sutta. It says you should go further. Okay, I'll go further. Something like that may have happened there. Everyone makes these kind of mistakes. Yeah, we stop short. We go, okay, now I'm, you know, this is just human nature, I think. Yeah. Eddie, more questions? Okay, fire away.
Ajahn Brahmali, is this similar to the Mahayana bliss and emptiness, you know?
Is what similar?
Bliss and emptiness. Samadhi. When there's emptiness, bliss arise. Is that similar? Is there any bliss arising? Or?
Bliss and emptiness are obviously come together because if you are empty, you tend to be blissful. Remember, the emptiness in the suttas means two different things. Emptiness in the Pali Suttas means either it means something is, there's no self there, it's empty of a self. This is the main meaning of emptiness in the Pali Suttas. But the second meaning of emptiness is that emptiness is like a gradual training of the mind where the mind becomes more and more empty of anything. This is what you find in the Chula Sunyata Sutta, the shorter sutta on emptiness, which is number 121 of the middle length sayings, Majjhima Nikaya. If you go back and read that sutta, do you promise to do that, Eddie?
Yeah.
Go back and read that.
Also, just
go back and read that sutta.
How about equanimity?
Yeah, let me finish my answer before you move on to the next one. Otherwise,
sorry.
What it says in the Chula Sunyata is that your mind gradually becomes more and more empty. Yeah, so it says it says you start off with the perception of forest because you are a monk or you are a layperson at the retreat center. You just have forest around you. That perception is empty of what? What do you think?
Empty of inherent existence.
It's empty of non-forest things like villages, like elephants, like noises, like all these kind of impressions you have in the city, right? Mm. In the forest, that's why the forest is good, it's peaceful. And then you take that further. So then you kind of start doing meditation practice. And then as you focus on the object, the perception of forest disappears. So it's empty of the perception of forest. All you have left is like the breath, for example. And then you go on and on and on until you reach the ultimate voidness or ultimate emptiness at the very end of the path. That's one way, right? Yeah. Does it make sense?
Just sorry. I just came to my mind, the seven factors of enlightenment, the last one is equanimity.
Yeah.
Does it link to?
They're all linked. Everything is linked. Oh. Nothing is not linked. Everything comes together. Yeah. Because equanimity, especially, is at the very high end of samadhi. Yeah, you come into the fourth jhana, etc. So this is where things become very, very peaceful. Things are very, very empty. And you're also on the brink of enlightenment itself. So you're almost there to, you know, to experience the higher kind of emptiness of no self, etc. But everything is linked on the path. And that's why, you know, the higher you are on the path, all the previous factors are part of the higher factors. Yeah. So if you have wisdom, well, actually, you are more virtuous as well. Virtue comes through wisdom. Huh? I was going to say that before, that, you know, I was saying that even though we develop satipatthana through satipatthana, even though mindfulness becomes stronger, yeah, I was saying it is not actually the purpose of satipatthana. In the same way as if you have sila, the purpose of sila is to take you to mindfulness, to take you to samadhi, and then when you get to samadhi, the sila becomes even stronger. But the purpose of sila is not to have more sila. The purpose is actually to gain mindfulness and samadhi. Huh? It's the same kind of argument you use. Right concentration, did I hear that? Yeah? Are you sure that's the right translation? What do you think?
Right concentration?
Yeah. Are you sure? Is that similar, I think?
Is that what Ajahn Brahm calls it? What is Ajahn Brahm called? Do you remember that?
Sorry? Stillness.
Stillness. Okay. I'm just testing you, yeah? Just testing you. See how much you have picked up. Yeah, just testing you. Stillness, right? Right, stillness. Because it's an important point of using words in a way which actually are, you know, don't mislead us to misunderstand what's going on here. So if I ask you back, then you learn more, you see. That's why I'm asking you. Asking you back, yeah. Yeah. If you're just listening, just listening is bad. You have to take part, yeah. So what do you think, Eddie? This is my question to you.
Stillness.
Stillness? Okay.
Yeah, it's you can put it in different ways, you know, right concentration, you know. Not. So if you compare to the samadhi, means it's the perfect concentration, you know, the highest concentration, samadhi.
So do you have a question?
No.
No question. Okay, good. Finished. Yeah. Okay. Okay, great. So sometimes it's nice for me to ask you back, because then I can test you out, you know, see what happens, see what you know. Yeah, good. Okay. Is there anything more, Robin? Any? Okay. He said that maybe we can do them now. Does anyone else want to say anything about this? So yeah, I'm probably gonna. It's already almost 10 past 10. So it's getting. I don't think I want to go on to the next topic. Let's take those other questions.
Okay, Ananda's question number 2. In that AN 646, Ajahn, could you please advise on the right translation for the following Pali passage? Acharya hete avuso pugala dulaba lokasming ye amatang datung kayena pusitwa viharanti.
Okay.
And he actually goes on and gives you Bhante Sajato's translation. Because it's incredibly rare to find individuals in the world who have direct meditative experience of the deathless element. Ajahn, in that passage, is the Lord Buddha referring to attaining to the deathless element through the recollecting, observing of the disappearance of one's body after emerging from the samadhi attained through samatha bhavana practice?
Okay, it's a little bit tangential to what we're doing now, but I think what he's talking about there is the expression kayena pusati. And kayena pusati, kaya is very often translated as body in Buddhism. Yeah, the kaya, we have the Kayanupassi, which we're talking about now in Satipatthana, is the contemplation of the body. Yeah, that's how it's translated. But sometimes you get these idiomatic phrases in the suttas. And ammatang kayena, ammatang kayena pusati, right? Ammatang kayena pusati. Ammatang datu kayena pusati. Okay, so ammatang datu. Ammatang is translated often as the deathless. Mata is death. Ammata is non-death. Yeah, so freedom from death or deathless. Datu is like element or property. So the property of deathlessness. You're not going to die anymore. And then pusati means to touch or to experience. So you experience that deathless element. So in other words, here what we're talking about is we're talking about the kind of the insight of stream entry, that sort of thing here, where you see the nature of reality and the mind leans towards the ending of samsaric existence. But then it has the interesting word kayena, because what that seems to be saying is that you are touching or experiencing the deathless element by the body. It's kind of weird. How can you touch the deathless element with the body? It sounds completely contradictory, because obviously the deathless element, if that is a good translation, or the deathless property, is something you have to experience with the mind, right? How can you physically, you can maybe touch the table with the body, but how can you express the deathless element? That's kind of a different thing here. So it's very strange, and I think the answer to that is that kayena very often has a idiomatic meaning to it, and you find that in a number of places. I'll give another example of where kayena is used. You touch kayena pusati, you touch the immaterial attainments with kayena, with the body. So how can you touch the immaterial attainments with the body? Well, it's because body there has an idiomatic meaning, and what it means immediate, direct, personal experience. That is the actual meaning, yeah? I've seen this personally, instead of inferentially or through the word of another or whatever, I have direct experience myself. That is the meaning here. And that must also be the meaning here. And that is why Bhantasarjata translates it as directly experience. Yeah, direct experience. Is that what he's got there, Robin? Direct, right? Yeah. So you can translate it as direct experience of the deathless element. You can call it personal experience. Anything like that would be an acceptable translation. I think that is precisely correct. And that has very important implications for other places in the suttas. For example, in the formula for the third jhana, which we will have a look at, hopefully, if there is another Satipatthana course on the last factor, yeah, right samadhi, we might have that down the track, if we're still alive. And there is no more... The world hasn't gone to war, and the Buddhist society has been bombed by whatever. So if we're still here, then we will look at the four jhanas. And one of the things that you find in the four jhana is that it says in there that it says, sukkang kayena patisangvedi, I think. Sukkang kayena patisangvedi. And sukkang is happiness. Patisangvedi means to experience, right? So you experience happiness. Again, this kayena word, with the body. And if you take that literally, it sounds like you're experiencing happiness with the physical body. But again, it has this other meaning, just that it has an immaterial attainment. It means that you have immediate, direct, personal experience of happiness. That is the actual meaning there. It does not mean with the physical body. It's a very important point. Otherwise, you get completely the wrong ideas of what these powerful samadhi states actually are about. They are not about the physical body anymore, because the physical body has been abandoned a long time ago. It is about the mental body, the broader idea of a personal personality. The suttas make an important distinction between two kinds of kaya. Kaya translated as body. One is called the rupa kaya. The other one is the nama kaya. Rupa kaya means physical body. Rupa is materiality, yeah, the material body. Nama kaya, nama is the mental aspect of existence. It's called nama, which means name. That is also called body. This is found in the Mahanidana Sutta, Digha Nikaya 15. Yeah, if you go to this is the greater sutta on causation, very well translated by Bhikkhu Bodhi and also by others. And it makes this distinction that kaya is both mental and physical. And here they are explicitly divided in this way, which is fascinating here. So this is the right way of as far as I can see, I don't think there can be much doubt about it personally, but anyway, so yes, I think that is a good translation, a correct translation by Bhante Sujata in that case. So. Yeah, okay, but I think because we have some bit of extra time, we kind of squeeze it in you. There's one behind you, yeah, as well. Yeah,
as well.
Nayana.
We'll
go here first. Yeah, let's go Nayana first. Okay, Nayana, fire away.
Yes, when the sutta was said, it's usually Buddha's, you said last week that he usually start with the sutta with the result, end result of the teaching.
Yeah.
So in this, he says that this is the path for leading one way or whichever way, is the end result would be purification of beings.
Yeah.
He's stopped short of saying that it's Nibbana. So could this be that he's saying purification of beings means it's a good thing, but it's not there at Nibbana?
I think Nibbana is implied in this. I'll just bring up the wording of this passage so that I get. I'm making sure you don't see all the rubbish that I'm seeing. Otherwise, so let me just bring up the exact passage because then I can tell you what is going on. So just going to go to the Majjhima Nikaya number 10. I have all the suttas on this really nice laptop. This is the best thing with laptops, to have all the suttas there. So let's see. Okay, so here we are. I got the Satipatthana Sutta in front of me. And so it's always good to kind of... So what it says, Ekayano ayang mago, this path goes in one direction only or leads to one. Satanang visuddhiya, for the purification of beings. Soka paridevang samatikamaya, which means to overcome soka. Soka parideva is sadness and grief. Dukkan domanasang attigamaya, for the ending of suffering and mental pain. Nyanasa adigamaya, for the achievement of the method or something like that. And then lastly, Nibbanasa Satchikiriyaya, for the attainment of Nibbana. So the whole thing is really there. And if you look at that description there, that description really refers to becoming an arahant. Because only when you become an arahant that you entirely overcome sorrow and lamentation and all of these kind of things. So I think that's what it refers to.
So could it be that it's a step towards that achievement rather than the whole path?
What is a step towards?
Satipatthana is step towards the end goal.
This is one of the distinctions I made last time, that Satipatthana can be divided into two aspects, two kind of levels, if you like. The first level, and the one that really matters, is Satipatthana leading to Samadhi. That is what you see in the suttas almost everywhere. Samma Sati leading to Samma Samadhi. Yeah. But sometimes the path is like expanded. And sometimes in the Satipatthana Sutta, you can see that Samadhi is included within Satipatthana, as if you contemplate the Samadhi experience itself. And of course, once you include Samadhi within Satipatthana, then it goes all the way to Nibbana. So there's two divergences. First of all, you practice Satipatthana to lead to Samadhi. Once you get to Samadhi, then you continue that practice, and then it leads to Nibbana. So there's two different stages, if you like. And this is how the path works all the way through. I made the point last time, you can say the same thing with right effort. The usual purpose of right effort is to take you to mindfulness. Samma vayama, right effort leads to samma sati, right mindfulness. But sometimes right effort includes all the way to the end of the path. Sometimes right effort includes the seven bhujangas, the seven factors of awakening. In which case, right effort goes all the way to include Satipatthana and also Samma Samadhi. So the factors can be viewed from different angles. There is the standard way it is viewed, and then there is like the expanded way. I mentioned this last time. And the standard way is what we normally see in the suttas. But occasionally you see the expanded version whereby the factor includes the whole path. This is what we're seeing in Satipatthana Sutta. Yeah,
yeah. Clear. Yeah. Now it's clear. Yeah.
Okay. I think it is time. Maybe we can save that question for this afternoon, Robin. Yeah, whatever that is. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Very good. So let's please have a nice lunch together, and we come back again at 12 noon. And we need a question. We need a question to, and I think we need to ask everyone what they think is the main misunderstanding of Satipatthana. Yeah, we want to have everyone's opinions, because it's kind of lots of misunderstandings out there, and I want to kind of add to the repertoire so that we have more food for next workshop we can we can talk about. So
perhaps if we just come straight back in here at 12, and we're going to separate into three groups, one in each room. And the three group leaders will be Molly, if you can just raise your hand so everyone knows who you are, there we go, and Nicholas, who ran away, he was sitting here before, and I will take the other group in one of the rooms as well, and we'll ask that question, spend about 15 minutes talking about it, and then come back in here to just give an overview. Okay, great. Thank you.